Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
Carrie, a lot of things have been happening on Latina Twitter that I have to share with you. At the Grammys, when Bad Bunny was performing, the closed captioning described it in brackets as non-English.
That's it? Just non-English?
Singing in non-English, I believe, were the exact words.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And so, and this is just terrible, okay? Because I'm thinking, with closed captioning and Grammys, like, with the other people that are singing, I feel like perhaps they prepare in advance for these things, too. Like, they may have lyrics available to them, or do you know if, like...
Closed captioning, generally, no. I don't know in the case of this, though, like...
Right. Like a live...
Yeah, live things are nothing. Nothing. Closed captioning is done at the time of, right?
Right.
It's not the same as, like, subtitles, which are done, like... You have a lot of time to do them, and then you put the things... You stitch them together, the visual and the two visuals together.
Right.
But closed captioning, no, is done live.
Right. But you think it could have figured out singing in Spanish, right? I mean,
at least say that it's Spanish, yeah.
So the part that's going viral is the non-English part. So it's, you know, creating this dichotomy between English and anything that isn't English, which is what many, at least Americans who speak English do. Whether or not that they do it on purpose or they just haven't been very thoughtful about it.
I wonder if the closed captioners are just told, if it's not English, just say non-English. And don't guess, because what if you guess incorrectly? Like, it's Polish and you say it's Russian or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Huh. I don't... But Spanish. Well, this is why I'm wondering, like, how much preparation, or, like, you know, at least, like, there's a commercial break and they're telling, you know, everyone that Bad Bunny's coming up. I feel like you would know you could say Spanish, singing in Spanish or something.
It seems very, like, okay, what's the second most likely language to be in this context? Spanish.
Right.
Maybe you're not 100% sure and you think maybe it's Portuguese, but it seems unlikely. It seems very likely that you would think this is Spanish and you'd be correct. But...
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know, like, what they're told, right? Like, they might have been told you cannot list the language just in case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have so many questions about... This is not me being upset or questioning the intent of, like, even the individual people that are doing the captioning system. It's the system where it's like, this is the best we've got for, you know, relaying this message.
Clearly, there could be some improvements made. At the very least, trying to figure out what language is likely to be given the situation. Like, they knew it was going to be Bad Bunny.
Yeah.
What language is it going to be? Probably Spanish or English. Nothing else, probably, right?
So, I just sent you a link to the latest SNL, or the weekend of the Grammys, SNL. That was the weekend of the Grammys, was Pedro Pascal. And he's a Spanish speaker. And he speaks English, too, of course. In this SNL skit, Pedro is playing a protective Latina mom. And there's this, a lot of translanguaging happening, this code-switching, if you want to call it, the Spanglish. But pay attention to the captioning.
Okay.
So did you see, we can pause here, did you see how it does the, in brackets, speaking non-English again? But managed to get mama, por favor. So they wrote out por favor. And then as the mom and the son were talking, the Spanish was just then completely ignored. And speaking non-Spanish wasn't used while they had some parts of English. So they would put, like, caption out the parts in English without even saying speaking non-English in between.
Is this one done by AI?
I guess, because it's the, captioning done by YouTube.
Yeah, so it just can't keep up. That's why. That's why when it was going back and forth between Spanish and English within a sentence, That's why we just can't keep up.
But this AI also does the speaking non-English thing, mm-hmm. which is interesting.
Well, I mean, that makes more sense, right? Like, an AI is going to know even less than a human would, right?
Right, right.
But it is interesting that it did pick up a few Spanish things. Like, so it's been taught por favor, it's been taught mama. I mean, mama's in English too, actually, so.
Yeah.
But it's been taught por favor. Because we, you know, English speakers use por favor sometimes too.
It's true. Especially if you're in a certain part of the country. In the U.S., if you're in the U.S.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like it's a
thing. Is por favor more widespread?
It's pretty widespread.
Really? Okay.
It's like one of those things that I feel like every English speaker knows. Like, you know, there's like a handful of French things that English speaker knows, and a handful of Spanish things every English speaker knows, or almost every English speaker knows. So.
Yeah. I do know bonjour.
Right.
And do. Okay, so by the time the Grammys were showing in the West Coast, the non-English, speaking non-English was replaced with an actual Spanish translation.
Oh, okay.
So I thought that was also interesting.
That's interesting. How'd they do that?
Oh, no. Okay, so CBS adds Spanish closed captioning to replays of Bad Bunny's Grammys performance after Backlash.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that, yeah. During the initial live broadcast, the captions only said speaking non-English and singing in non-English. And when he went up to accept in a Grammy, his acceptance speech was partially in Spanish. And once again, the captions only said speaking non-English. And so that, too, it comes up again later in the broadcast. Why is it still speaking non-English? Is there really just a strict rule that says you cannot say, because at this point, you know what's happening. What language he's speaking that's not English. Turns out, it is generally standard practice for live closed captioning, where the captioners don't have the capability to quickly add translations. The speaking non-English is a catch-all for all languages and is built into the system.
Yeah, so I was right. It's just what they do, what they've been trained to do. Yeah.
Right. And then, so they say that although the lyrics for both of the songs that Bad Bunny performed are readily available, they don't count for ad-libs or expletives that may or may not be bleeped while doing something live.
And this is a hard job. Captioning is really hard.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's why it's like, I'm not mad at the captioners. I think the point, too, though, that so this article is also bringing up the fact that, like, they should have been prepared because they knew what the Grammy schedule was.
At the very least, they should have been able to say Spanish.
Right. So that's what I'm thinking. Like, my thought was, yeah, when things are live, they can go all over the place. But when it's the Grammys or, like, any other show like that, it's pretty scheduled. And so what kind of preparation can we do? And again, this goes to the point of people that really need closed captioning, and you're just not getting enough information. Like, that's not I guess the people that, you know, need the closed captioning can assume that Bad Bunny is speaking Spanish, but what if he's, like, trying out some French or whatever? I don't know. Yeah, I just think it's not a complete picture for people who are relying on closed captioning.
Right. And again, there's probably never going to be a way to make it complete, but to make it more complete. Like, this is information that would be easily added. At the very least, this is Spanish as opposed to any other language.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, maybe, okay, if there's any ad-libbing, we're just going to have to ignore it, but we'll just put in the lyrics, like, since we know what song it's going to be. And, like, maybe make a note, like, this is these are just the lyrics of the song. Any ad-libbing won't be added. I don't know. There's probably a way to handle this. And maybe going forward they will. I don't know. But I'm hoping they're thinking about it, at least.
No, I agree. I mean, I think, why aren't we making more efforts to do things, even if they can't be perfect or...
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, just try to do a little bit better rather than just not doing it at all. It's it's an all or nothing thing
that
I don't think we should fall into. I think we should always think, is there at least a small thing that we could do to make it better? And then later,
right,
make another small thing, as opposed to just being like,
I'm not going to try.
I'm not going to try, or
it
has to be 100% perfect. It's like, no, there's lots in between there, and let's just try to get closer to better as we go forward.
Right. And I'll say one more thing about it. So there was an interview with Dr. Yadamar Bonilla. Sorry if I've said that wrong. Who is a professor in the Department of Africana, Puerto Rican, and Latino Studies at Hunter College. And director of the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at CUNY. And Bad Bunny's Puerto Rican. Okay, so Dr. Bonilla says, I think the audience was disappointed. Apparently, this is the standard practice when there's not a multilingual person captioning to just write non-English, if that's what they hear. Folks felt like, okay, you're making history here. For the first time, you have a Spanish language act nominated for Album of the Year. This is the largest streaming artist in the world. You know that he sings and speaks only in Spanish. Do better, Grammys. So it's just like the thought that I had too. Like, there has to be some preparation put in beforehand, right? For all of these people, just to prep, like, you know, like, this is what's going to happen tonight, you know. It's not going to be possible, it's not going to be perfect all the time, because maybe people throw in words from other languages that the captioner won't know, but you did know what he was singing and what he was going to sing, and that it was going to be in Spanish. So, I think that's the big point. Well, maybe they learned an important lesson, because this went viral very quickly. But yeah, it's all really interesting, and the Saturday Night Live, the YouTube captioning system put the same thing, so I guess now we do really know it's kind of standardized practice here. But I think there's... And Saturday Night Live is live, too.
Yeah, Saturday Night Live is live. But are these captions that? No, they're from YouTube, right?
No, right. I mean, I guess I wasn't watching it live. And I don't use closed captioning. So I wonder what it looked like there. I don't know.
No idea.
But probably similar if it's standardized.
Probably similar. But probably caught more of the English words.
Yeah.
And probably said not English more often. Like
when it was, yeah. Yeah, anyway, it's all very interesting and worth thinking about all these things.
Yes.
If you know, because again, it's all about accessibility to people other than just English speaking.
Or English reading.
Or yeah, English speaking, English reading. I think that's kind of like a good intro into what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really fun episode and so charming. So charming.
Yes. Oh, before we get to the interview, we want to remind everyone that we do have a Patreon. We have different levels. There's stickers. There's a mug. There are bonus episodes and you get access to all the bonus episodes we've ever done so far. And they tend to be fun and salty. Mm-hmm. So if you want to be a Patreon supporter, go to patreon.com/vocalfriespod.
Yeah.
We're so excited to have Ilan Stavans, the publisher of Restless Books and a passionate lover of dictionaries with a collection of over 300 now housed in his personal collection at the University of Pennsylvania. Wow. That's awesome. He has published an assortment of books about language, including Spanglish, The Making of a New American Language, Dictionary Days, A Defining Passion, Resurrecting Hebrew, and How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish. He serves as a consultant to the Oxford English Dictionary and lives in Amherst, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, welcome.
It's a pleasure.
I'm so excited. I already mentioned this to you, but I've had you on my shelves forever. It didn't say in the intro, but you're also, I'm going to hold this up for Carrie. You are the editor of the Norton Anthology of Latino Literature, which is one of my favorite tomes.
Oh, great.
You have a new edited volume out, The People's Tongue, Americans and the English Language. We want to talk to you about that today. And I want to ask, first of all, why did you decide to write, to compile this, and why now?
Well, thank you again for having me on your podcast. I'm thrilled. I decided to put together The People's Tongue for a variety of reasons. The first one is that as a publisher of Restless Books, we've been bringing out volumes devoted to immigration, to contemporary literature in translation for a decade. And this is the book that is marking the 10th anniversary celebration of Restless. So I'm thrilled to be bringing it to people and to kind of as a party cake to celebrate it with everybody as a statement of the effort that the incredible staff, the translators, the editors, the distributors have invested into this wonderful project, Restless Books, that is based in Brooklyn. And the second is because I have been an immigrant in this country for over 35 years. I am very grateful to this country in spite of all its imperfections and its challenges. And I wanted to give back to it a statement that reflects how the language I speak right now with you, the language that I have adopted and adapted from the environment, is, I feel it's mine, but I feel it's in constant change. And this anthology seeks to reflect, to map out how the English language has changed for over 450 years from before the independence in 1776 to the present. Voices from all backgrounds, indigenous and immigrant and young and old, teachers and politicians and activists and translators and lexicographers. And I wanted to create a kind of symphony of voices that would explain and express the degree to which this incredible language that we have is in constant change and nothing is ever static in it.
Yes, absolutely true.
So you call English the people's tongue. What do you mean by that?
I call it the people's tongue because when compared to many other languages, say Spanish, which is one of the languages that I was born into, or French, or Italian, or Hebrew, or German, all of which have an academy, like the Académie Française or the Real Academia Española de la Lengua, that supposedly safeguards the language, protects it. It's the authority that legislates on what is accepted and what is rejected in those languages. In English, we don't have an academy. We don't have anybody telling us what words to use or what words not to use. Of course, we have teachers and we have parents and we have dictionaries. But the language is ours. It's the people's tongue. We can choose to change the meaning of a word, like the word bad. When I first arrived to this country, the word bad in 1985 meant bad. And then after Michael Jackson and many others, the word bad doesn't mean bad. It means good.
Right.
So it's something that we all decide to do unconsciously or consciously. And it is for us to shape the future as we did in the past and in the present.
I love that. And as linguists, we really want people to know that language is always changing. And I think it's a new concept to a lot of people. What would you say to people that are kind of like grammarians, if you will? Is this like a way for them to see the language as something different?
I would invite them to imagine a dinner table where Thomas Jefferson and Emily Dickinson and Zora Neale Hurston, and Joy Harjo, and, James Baldwin were all sitting together and discussing what it means to be maybe an American or simply what it means to be human at different moments in time. The first thing that we would notice if we were sitting at that table is that the language that they use is very different. Each of them is employing the language of the time and space to which they belong. And Emily Dickinson would not understand the word online or woke. And the same thing would happen with Jefferson or even with James Baldwin. So there are many, many words that are jumping into our language all the time. They come from different corners of society, young people. They produce many more new words than older people who tend to be more conservative. And it is, even though we always have a kind of base, a bank of words that travels across time, it is rotating, it is being renewed, the meanings get transformed, we come up with new words. And that is what makes the languages living languages, because a language that is dead is a language that doesn't lend or doesn't borrow from other languages, that is static. Think of, I don't know, ancient Greek or Latin. Those are languages that don't need the word airplane or the word, I don't know, something for Chinese food or for Mexican food, because they are frozen in time. And the beauty of the English language, though it is a colonial language that we received, was imposed on us, is that we haven't been passive. We have been changing it constantly. And it's today, for better or worse, the most jazzy and innovative language. And it's because of spoken word poets, and it's because of jazz musicians and singers and actors and translators and so many people, and just people plain and simple in the kitchen or in the yard or playing baseball, soldiers and workers. This is the language of all of us. And I love the fact that I share these words with people who are no longer alive, who are not yet alive. And I am a conduit from the past to the future, the way all of us are.
That's great. I love that so much. I've done a couple of interviews about the word Latinx, and I get so much hate mail about this word because I say, you know, there are people that use it, so we should respect that. Why do you think people are resistant to something like Latinx?
It's a good question, and you will get from me also a controversial answer, not a hate answer, but, you know, I think that the fact that we in the Latino community have different ways of calling ourselves is a statement of a community in constant change, in formation or reconfiguration. We are Republican and we're Democrat. We are young and we are not so young. We are recent arrivals as immigrants, and we are Americans that have been here for a long period of time. We can be Cuban Americans, Mexican Americans, Salvadoran Americans, Argentinian Americans, even Spanish or Iberian Americans. And for a long, long time, the shifting names and categories have been a statement of how cohesive or not cohesive we are as a community. We have been the Spanish-speaking people, the Spanish people, Hispanics, Latino, Latina, Mestizo, Mestiza, Latinx. And my impression is that Latinx is a statement of a moment where the gender fluidity is very important, and where the X also comes from a background in history that announces the way that certain regions of the world, including Mexico, moved from spelling its name with a J, Mexico, to spelling it with an X the moment it became independent, in order to connect with the Aztec and Nahuatl past. In the early days of the Mexican Republic, the idea was that that X was closer to mestizos than the J that we were having from Spain. And so we spelled Mexico, we spelled Texas with an X also, Texas in Spanish. I'm not so sure that it's inevitable that in the Spanish language, because it's a Romance language, nouns have gender. A bee is a she, and a ball is a he, el balón. And so trying to eliminate that or pushing it to a kind of neutral sense is controversial. And I am ambivalent about it. Sometimes I think this is a wonderful thing. It's the language should not impose on us the gendered view of the world. And in other ways, and actually more often than not, I think languages are patterns. We can resist them, we can transform them, but they also shape us. And we can fight for gender and sexual fluidity in many different ways aside from language. I, on the one hand, respect the way languages are structured, but I also love contamination, pollution in language.
I love it.
So yeah. I kind of go back and forth.
Yeah, I totally get that ambivalence. I feel the same way, but I'm also not part of the community, so it's like not really for me to say either way.
Well, it is. I mean, everybody who uses the word should have something to say, not only the community, but I get your point.
Yeah. So how did you pick each of the pieces in this book?
This was the product of a real nutritive dialogue with students. I taught a class called The Making of Dictionaries, where I posed this question to the students. Do we really need dictionaries? Can we live in a world without anybody compiling words in between two covers and telling us these are the words that are accepted? And they're, because the moment you publish a dictionary, if you publish it in print, it is immediately useless. There are so many new words that are already being employed outside that did not enter that dictionary. So we did a deep dive into the history of the many dictionaries in the English language, and in particular into American dictionaries, and how did the early founding fathers and figures like Noah Webster try to distinguish the language that Americans were speaking in the colonies vis-a-vis the ones in, you know, the motherland. And that generated all sorts of discussions, and the students were bringing in poems and stories and fragments of novels, and then I was bringing in more. And I realized that the question had pushed us to reimagine the sequence of a tradition, who says what, how. And the selection was done ultimately by me, but with enormous gratitude to the students who were proposing a Sojourner Truth's statement of what makes me a woman, the Gettysburg Address, Tony Kushner in Angels of America. I mean, so many wonders. The whole point here is that language doesn't belong to lexicographers, doesn't belong to anybody, but to everybody that uses it. So there are astronauts here, and there are homemakers, and there are comedians. This is who is using the language all the time. And that's why I think the title, The People's Tongue, is hoping to bring forth that kind of a collective view of the real shapers of language, which is just about everybody who says something.
In your intro to this, you quote Emily Dickinson, which is like the perfect quote. Let me just find it really quick. A word is dead when it is said, some say. I say it just begins to live that day. Why did you want to start your introduction with that quote?
Emily Dickinson is my hero. I live two blocks away from where she hid for most of her life. She was this kind of very short, very private woman who seldom went out of her house. We don't really know all the complexities of her mental health and challenges, but she thought poetry as a way to express herself and absolutely revolutionized the way we look at language and the way we look at punctuation. Her punctuation might be one of the most original things any American poet has ever produced. And every time I go to the office, I pass by Emily and I imagine her bringing down her little basket of candy for the neighborhood kids who didn't know her directly but would run to get those candies. And I imagine myself in a dialogue with her. She published only a handful of poems during her life. She was very insecure about her poetry. But her poetry has reconfigured the way we do things. And I mean, if I could have quoted her more, I would have quoted her more in this book. She's quoted, as you said, at the beginning in the introduction, and then there's a section in the book itself as well. I mean, I don't tire of just going back to Emily Dickinson's poems. They are just superb.
Do you watch the TV show, Dickinson?
I watch the TV show. I've seen the movies. I've read every biography you can imagine. None of them really captures, but they are kind of approximations. And I like that she remains a mystery, that we don't really know who she was, and that her poetry both reveals and conceals who her dreams and her vision of things.
So in this volume, you include everyone from Sugar Hill Gang to Walt Whitman to Dr. Seuss. Why was that important to have this wide expanse of individuals?
I am a professor, and I am very uncomfortable within academia. I think academia is, on the one hand, a superb opportunity to devote yourself to thinking and to researching and to connect with extraordinary students, young, that will allow you to get the temperature of the world as it is right now. On the other hand, academia can be incredibly isolating. It removes us from the rest of the world. It's pretentious. It's arrogant. And I wanted to really delve into pop culture, into the lowbrow, so to speak, and the highbrow, to just about everybody. Richard Pryor is in the book, and so is Lucille Ball, but Noah Webster and many presidents and many so-called serious scholars of language, because I think it is time to break this unnecessary imaginary barriers between the so-called people in the know and the people who supposedly don't know. But if you're using the English language, you know, and sometimes not knowing, so to speak, I put this in quotations, gives you freedom, much more freedom than having to follow certain grammatical and syntactical rules because you learned this in class.
You mentioned how pretentious academia is. This is very true. I'm a first generation college student, so I did not just like quite comprehend until I got there. But in that same vein, I was taking Spanish in college, and we were supposed to do a report, and I said that I wanted to do it on Spanglish, which you're very familiar with. And the instructor told me that I could not do that because Spanglish was not legitimate.
What a shame.
And this was really hurtful to me because I wasn't a linguist yet. And, you know, my dad speaks Spanglish. You know, I grew up around it. And this is what I'm told. I just really appreciate you mentioning how stifling and isolating academia can be.
And you know, it's good also to be told no, because when you're told no and you have a fighting spirit, you find ways to say yes. You might come back 5 years later, the teacher is no longer in the classroom, you don't know, you don't have even an email, but you are going to answer that question or respond to that no in different ways. I, as you know, love Spanglish. I think it's exciting, it's beautiful, it's improvisational, it is what people speak. And I think languages and formation are always that way. They are the result of necessity. People use the words that they can, and if somebody understands them, the act of communication took place. So yeah. Why limit that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's patterned. So people think it's late. Yeah. They call it so-called lazy. There's no lazy language, for one thing.
There's no lazy language. There's no broken language.
Exactly.
All languages are either broken or are fixed, depending on how we see them. And Spanglish is anything but lazy. It has speed. It has power. It has energy. It has much more of all those qualities than many other so-called standard languages. I feel that Spanglish is unstoppable.
I completely agree with you. I think it's so beautiful the way that my dad speaks Spanglish. And every time, like, I'll ask him, because I did not actually grow up speaking Spanish, like that, you know, third generation American kid that didn't, you know, I was the youngest grandchild, so my grandparents were gone, so I didn't learn Spanish. But when I ask him to define something for me, or what's the word for this in Spanish, he'll always second guess himself. And it makes me really sad, you know, like as if he does not know the language that he was born into.
He must be part of a generation that was told that if they don't speak full-fledged Spanish, then they have betrayed that language, or they are inefficient, or they are handicapped, or they are whatever the term would be here. And that creates a kind of psychological, you know, knot in your brain that you are not quite authentic. You are not legitimate. And it's baloney. It doesn't make sense. It's languages. Spanish began as Spanglish today by stealing from vulgar Latin, by incorporating elements from the environment. The highbrow, pretentious professors and scholars were saying, either speak Latin or don't speak at all. Yeah. And look, three centuries later, you have great masterpieces written in that language. So it's just the shape of things and the tension between generations.
Yes, it's a tale. Every generation, there's the same complaints over and over again.
Absolutely.
Whichever language you're talking about is becoming more and more barbaric over time.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So which of the pieces in this is your favorite?
Or is that like picking a favorite child?
It's like picking a favorite child, although you might have one you will never say.
Okay.
You will keep it to yourself. But I can tell you of many that I love. You know, I because I grew up in Mexico and didn't know Spanish, when I came to the United States already at 25, Allison, who would later on become my wife, showed me for the very first time a Dr. Seuss book. And for me, it was like thunder and lightning just taking over. The beauty of that, of the language of Dr. Seuss, and now we know the complexity of his own mind and certain stereotypes that he used of Chinese Americans and Jewish Americans during the Second World War. But the beauty of, Green Eggs and Ham or The Grinch or The Lorax. And when I went to the folks of the estate, they would only allow me to use two or three lines because it is forbidden. So I just couldn't not have something by Dr. Seuss. But had I had the choice, I would have included the entire Green Eggs and Ham or the entire Lorax, which is not that big. I love, you know, it's not a linguistic statement itself. It's a political statement, but I think the Gettysburg Address by Lincoln is one of the most superbly written pieces, concise, direct, powerful, emotional, lasting. And I am an absolute student of that. I included in the book tweets by President Donald Trump. Probably that is the one thing he has written himself. Everything else has been written by others. And then he claims that he wrote those books or those speeches. And, you know, they are nasty. They are ugly. They are repetitive. But they are part of the language, too. And he really pushed people in many ways through those. So I think social media is an essential channel for language. And either those in power or those without power, we all meet on our tweets and our Instagrams and reinvent the language.
Yeah, the Trump one, I just had to laugh. So just so people know, it's all of the insults directed at CNN in his tweets and nothing else.
All of them.
All of
without
them.
Exception.
All of them.
All of them.
It's and incredible.
It's an ugly exercise in reading.
Yes.
I mean, I didn't want to. I thought I have to subject the reader to read again, fake news in capital, fake news with exclamation marks, fake news, fake news. But this is a guy who is hammering us with a single message. And, you know, I have to also confess a little story here. After I put together the book, I started asking for permissions. And there were three or four very prominent writers whose names I'd rather not mention, who said, I'm sorry, I am not participating in a book with Donald Trump. And I had to make a case. I, who dislike Trump thoroughly, I had to make a case that, you know, for better or worse, he's using the language the way we're using it too. And we need to get the whole panoply of possibilities here. And fortunately, all of them in the end said, absolutely, this it's a good choice, etc. But it was controversial at that point already.
I could see that. I could see, like, if I saw his name, I would be worried. But then when you actually see right. what the passage is, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and in the context of the volume, it's important.
Right. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, I know what you mean. Like, when I saw Donald Trump, I was like, what is this? And then I went, I was like, oh.
Is he a writer?
Yeah. I know. Because you say, like, he actually wrote them. And then you get there and it's like tweets. It's so amazing.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
Knowing that Donald Trump is in here, and even just like, I'm like thinking David Foster Wallace, who I always found really pretentious and hard to read. He's mm-hmm. in here.
Right.
But like all of them are so carefully selected and you see why they fit together. What would you say to someone who's like, who's a reader that would see a name and be like, why would this be included?
I would say be patient, look at how it relates to other things. And, you know, maybe you will come to the same realization that I do that, you know, the language in that, in the same words, in the same language, we can say hateful things. And we can say endearing things, and it's up to us to decide how we're going to use it.
Absolutely. So you have in here Richard Henry Pratt from Kill the Indian, Save the Man, boarding schools and killing the language of these indigenous children.
Absolutely.
And so like that's in here, but it's not like you're saying, I endorse this. You're saying, here is what, you know, is part of the history of English.
Exactly, Megan. I mean, the history of English is the history of survival and oppression within the language. It is the silences that the language conveys that are in the background of all those indigenous languages that have struggled to remain alive. Some of them have been able to, and others haven't. It is the desire by immigrants to retain their immigration languages as they assimilate into the so-called melting pot or salad bowl or however we call it. The language that we speak, English, is a colonial language. We inherited it. We have pushed it around. It's very plastic, very elastic, and we have added many new words. We have eliminated other words, but it is also a kind of cemetery of the sounds that have perished along the way. And for every beautiful word that one hears, there are traces of other words that haven't made it in other languages, in other people. And I think that what I wanted to do, what the students and I were doing, is reflecting that presence of the language as a kind of stable and unstable a field where there are ghosts who are talking to us from the past, and they are yet unborn speakers who will say, thank you for this, or this is unfortunate that you did this, and now we'll carry the language forward. But in the case of slaves, the slave trade, the case of the indigenous population, the case of many who crossed the borders and for a long period of time until the 1950s, they had to live in a sink or swim reality where, like your father or your grandfather, it could not speak Spanish because they were told, go back home, go back to Mexico. Here you're speaking only English. And now we're more permissive, we're more elastic. We account for that transformation. But this is not to say that it isn't happening right now as well. I mean, every time we use this language, it also states that we're not using other languages. And it's a Darwinian world, the world of languages, where some survive and some don't. There are approximately 7,000 different indigenous languages alive throughout the Americas right now. And some of them only have two or three speakers. So will they survive? It's a big effort. On the other hand, the arrival of Spanglish, which is a new language, can generate a lot of discomfort among people because it is displacing English or displacing Spanish or doing other things. So it's the linguistic field is always tense, always filled with kind of bombs and explosions.
Going back to Donald Trump, though, I've mentioned on the podcast before that I don't like how people on the left say that he doesn't speak good English or he isn't even speaking English. Because when we say something like that about Donald Trump, it doesn't hurt Donald Trump. It hurts people, immigrants, people like my dad,
sure.
You know, people yeah. that have been historically minoritized. It hurts them. It doesn't hurt Donald Trump.
It absolutely, you're absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things that we have forgotten in this very divided moment in American history where we have dehumanized those that don't think like us, this is very dangerous. It is very important to recognize that, you know, we are in a country where democracy is a messy affair by definition. People have different views, and by dehumanizing them, we are dehumanizing a part of ourselves as well, because the voice of those that don't think like us help us shape our own views. And it's important to give them credit, as important as it is for them to give us credit. And I think they should start with language. I was writing for a publication yesterday. The article's going to be published soon. The difference between how Latino Republicans and Latino Democrats use the English language.
And yes.
It is dramatic.
It is so dramatic.
It's so dramatic. You were talking about the Latin X. Forget that. I mean, the Republicans will use Hispanic. Democrats will use Latino. It's as if these were totally different minorities. The conservatives will not like Spanglish. The progressives will like Spanglish, but only if it takes a certain taste or go in a certain direction. So it's very interesting how we can demonize those that don't speak like us, but it's very dangerous doing that because we're demonizing ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. And you're so right. I'm so glad that you said that because I was like, okay, Latinos that are Republican say Hispanic. And I'm glad to hear someone else like confirm my thoughts on
yes,
this.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, I've never identified with that word. It emphasizes the Spanish-speaking part of it. And
exactly. Yeah, it goes back to Spain.
And again, I didn't grow up speaking Spanish.
But on the other hand, I mean, it generates discomfort, but Spain is half of what Latin America is, the other or a portion of what Latin America is. So it's we can't negate it. It's important to live with it and to digest that heritage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, Latin is just the language behind
the whole thing. You know, I was also writing the other day about the fact that I'm sure in your neck of the wood as well, whenever somebody gives a speech or a sermon or opens up a kind of discussion, it has become fashionable to acknowledge that these lands were taken from indigenous population, and you list the indigenous population as it should be done. But very seldom, in fact, I haven't heard it, does anybody say that the language itself that we're using to acknowledge that usurpation is a colonial language, in the English language. So it's not only that the lands were taken, but the language was taken as well. But on the other hand, you know, Walter Benjamin said once that the history of every civilization is the history of barbarism. We're barbaric and civilized at the same time, and those two sides keep on fighting constantly. Barbaric comes from the Berbers, which were a group that was perceived to be un-European, threatening, undermining the foundation of Greek and Roman civilizations. And the word has mutated over time. And the fact is that we employ that term barbaric as a synonym for primitive whenever we want to feel that we are more sophisticated than somebody else, or whenever we want to endorse certain values. Language itself, it's like when we talk about, you know, does a firearm kill people, or is it the person who used the firearm who is killing people? The same thing happens with language. The same beautiful words can be used for very destructive efforts. And the word barbaric is a statement of that type of thing. The word barbaric as such is so interesting because of its history. There's another part I want to say that I think is important. The book also wants to account for the language of the deaf in this country and how the deaf have been perceived as dumb, as unintelligent, incapable of full language. And there is a whole parallel or concurrent debate within the book of the language of those that don't use verbal language and how they are perceived, how we perceive ourselves, and how do we shape a tongue that can be through silences, can be through gestures. And it goes back to the 18th century and the 19th century. And some of these statements can be very demeaning today, but not including them in the book, I think, would be worse than including them and contextualizing them in the proper sense so that people figure out that we speak languages of silence and we speak languages of sound. We speak with our tongue and we speak with our hands. And all that is communication.
Absolutely. And without including things like this, which may be of their time, we don't understand how we got to the point today where we've completely erased sign language from the conversation.
You know, there's a beautiful piece in the book by Amy Tan, who talks about how her mother, who was the immigrant from China, was always told that her English was incomplete. And yet, in how Amy needed to serve as a translator for the mother when she would call a doctor or a tax collector or what have you, because the mother, who could express herself, felt inferior by using by being told all the time. And that, to Amy Tan, became a kind of stepping stone to embracing the English language, but rediscovering the Chinese of her mother, the tensions between progressive ways of embracing the English and also keeping the immigrant language with you along the way. And I think that's very important. I would say that the difference between the immigrant journey, I mean, this might be too broad and too general, but it used to be a time, as I was mentioning before, where immigrants needed to cancel their own immigrant language in order to become Americans. And now we're more open to bilingualism, multilingualism. We realize that in the global economy, we need to have other languages, and immigrants can be engines of entrepreneurship in that sense. We are much more committed to teaching foreign languages on campus than we were before, and you know, from Arabic to Chinese to Spanish. And I think that is a statement of how the country has also been changing. It's very, I feel very moved when a student who is a Latina like you, Megan, can recover her language, the language that wasn't spoken at home, and then feel very proud about it and pass it on to the next generation.
Absolutely.
That's a wonderful statement.
Yeah. And just because I didn't have a relationship with my father in Spanish when I was younger, we can still have that as I'm older now.
Exactly. Yeah.
It might sound a little bit different, but that's okay.
That's okay. That's part of the deal.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, every generation's different anyway. So you're just different from other parts of the same generation. That's all.
And then you, when you're young, you're the progressive. You're the one that is pushing things. And eventually you're going to become old and you're going to be the one that the younger generation is going to criticize.
We all play
different roles in life.
It's true. It's the circle of life. What a beautiful thing. Well, we're running out of time here with you. This has been so amazing.
Yes.
I have loved this. I've loved talking to the two of you.
Oh, thank you. My gosh. Thank you. I mean, there's so much in this. I could talk for hours. Is there anything that you just really want to convey to our listeners about this volume?
I want to say two things. The first one is, as you read a volume that is an anthology, many of these things are just portals to take you to different places. So if there's a segment of a novel, maybe you would be inspired to read the whole novel or to read more of the poetry of Dunbar or Emily Dickinson or, you know, any of the poets that is represented there. And the second is that I truly have loved spending time with the two of you.
Aww.
I love the kind of casual, passionate way that you're doing your podcast.
Aww, thank you.
It feels that in and of itself is a statement of the language. Aww. How we use the language.
Thank you so much. It's definitely a labor of love here on the Vocal Fries.
Yes, definitely.
And we're super cash.
Yes.
If we're anything, it's super cash.
It's great.
And we always leave our listeners with one final message.
Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Be well. Continue doing that good work.
Oh, thank you.
This month, we would like to thank Colin Korna for supporting us. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you.
We do. And just as a reminder, if anyone else wants to join, www.patreon.com/vocalfriespod.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.